begin by thanking Matt and Kendrick for organizing this meeting, which has had a very nice range of topics. And hopefully I'll extend it a little further. I'm going to talk about a sort of a small phenomenon that was overlooked for several decades, and which we only recently realized. And my guess is that there are many more small phenomena which could have significant impact on our picture of the universe. It's worth looking for such things. This is work done initially with Wei-Li Pan in this preprint, which should shortly appear in PRL, and then extended with my PhD student, Job Feldbrugger, and Perimeter's Eric Schnetter. I just want to begin by telling you the strange story of this work, which is we weren't looking for this effect. We were actually studying quantum cosmology, which has very little to do with this effect. But what we found is that we could perform the quantum gravitational path integral for a perfect fluid of radiation and conformally coupled scalar fields exactly. And you find a bounce, in other words, smooth passage through the singularity. And then we wanted to study the perturbations, so we did it to linear and nonlinear order. And we're very surprised to discover that perturbation theory broke down not where we expected it, which is at the singularity, but in fact broke down, I mean, it does break down there, but not only there, it breaks down at large times. And the way this happens is that as you expand in the strength of the perturbation, you find secularly growing terms. And so at order epsilon squared, you find that actually the expansion is in epsilon squared times kt. And when k, it's a dimensionless number, but when it gets large, when kt becomes of order 1 over epsilon, the whole perturbation expansion fails. And so we're a bit mystified by this. Since it's an expanding universe and you have weak perturbations, which are surely just redshifting away, how can it be that perturbation theory fails? But fail it does, and the whole talk will be about this failure and its implications. So just to begin, ours is a very, very lucky generation, which is the first to see this picture of the whole universe. That vast shore washed with the farthest sea, as in Romeo and Juliet. And it really is a miraculous thing that we can see this, and that it fits so well to the very, very simplest ideas about density variations and in cosmology. It fits with stunning precision. So what I'm going to do is take what we've learned from this, which is that the perturbations we see are of the simplest character, Gaussian random noise, nearly scale invariant spectrum, and I'm going to extrapolate that spectrum down to very short distances. That's probably the most conservative thing you can do. And then ask on very small scales, what did those tiny density perturbations do? And as we'll see, the answer is actually quite interesting. So these are the standard adiabatic perturbation modes. Actually, for the purposes of what I will study, it won't really matter too much if they were adiabatic and isocurvature, but this will be the minimal case. The peculiar thing about these modes is that they were synchronized with the Big Bang. That's why the Doppler peaks in the previous pattern occur at these very special places, because the modes have had this mode, for example, grows, reverses. This mode has reached its first maximum since the Big Bang. This mode has passed through a minimum. Modes that we see here hit their second maximum, and so on. So they're all synchronized with the Big Bang. They all behave in the same way. Of course, in a radiation-dominated universe, there is no preferred scale. With a scale invariant spectrum, there's no preferred scale. all the modes behave in the same way. So if we plot them as a function of kt, they all fit on this curve, on these curves. So here is the Newtonian potential in red. Let's imagine there's an underdense region, so a positive Newtonian potential. And then as time proceeds, the amplitude of the perturbation mode oscillates like this. And so as the mode has oscillated several times and passes far inside the horizon, in fact, it fits perfectly to a cosine of kt. This is the dominant mode in the density perturbation irradiation-dominated universe. Gravitational back reaction becomes completely negligible. And so all you have is modes oscillating as if they were in a perfect radiation-dominated background universe. Furthermore, since radiation is conformally invariant, because the stress tensor vanishes, in fact, you can just factor out the expansion of the background. And so you can treat them as if they were in flat space-time. So to picture what these modes do, you can just take a box in flat space-time, put in a collection of modes, put them all in with an ensemble where I only have the cosine mode. In other words, delta is non-zero, the velocities are zero. Let it go, and they will all oscillate. And that's that will describe very accurately what the radiation actually does on sub-horizon scales. So to study that problem, so here I just repeat that. Since radiation is conformally invariant, you can forget about the expansion of the background, as long as you can ignore gravitational back reaction. But that's true on sub-horizon scales. And so you just work in a Weyl frame in which the background is Minkowski space-time. So now we have a very simple problem, although nonlinear. We take the stress tensor of the radiation with pressure equal to 1/3 of the density. It's traceless. And so the equations of energy and momentum conservation in Minkowski space-time are four equations, because there's four free indices there, for four unknowns, which are the density and the four velocity. And because the four velocity really has only three independent components, because its square is minus one. So we have four equations for four unknowns, and everything follows from these equations. So a very interesting property of these equations, which we will see, is that in the absence of viscosity, so if I assume the mean free path is very short compared to the wavelengths I'm studying, then viscosity is negligible. Then in the absence of viscosity, these equations conserve entropy and vorticity. In other words, if I follow the local fluid equations, I never depart from local thermal equilibrium, and I never generate vorticity. It's just a conservation law consequence of these equations, like Kelvin's theorem. However, as we'll see, even when viscosity is absent, these equations will fail because shocks form. And as soon as you form a shock, the differential equations break down because the gradients become large. In fact, they go to infinity in finite time. So the differential equations break down, and entropy and vorticity are generated, but in a completely predictable way, that even though the differential equations fail, the fluid equations fail, energy and momentum conservation are still sufficient to uniquely determine the evolution of the shocks. And you can calculate exactly how much entropy and vorticity is generated. So by studying this process, we will actually see that the early universe did contain deviations from local thermal equilibrium, entropy production, and also the early universe generated vorticity. So let's study the simplest case. Take a plane wave perturbation in a radiation-dominated universe and see what happens. So here's a very simple Mathematica code that evolves the density and the velocity. And what you see is that a sinusoidal wave steepens into these shocks. So the density has a sharp edge and then a nearly linear profile afterwards. The velocity looks more like a Heaviside function. And this process can actually be studied exactly. Physically or intuitively, the reason the shock forms is very simple. The fluid velocity is larger behind the shock than in front of it. In the energy deficit, in an overdense region, the fluid velocity will be higher. In the energy deficit region, it will be lower. And so the peaks, the crests of a wave, catch up with the troughs, and the velocity difference between the crests and the troughs is epsilon. And so in a time of order lambda over epsilon, the crests catch up with the troughs and you form a shock. So if you want to see it exactly, we go to light cone coordinates, x plus or minus CST. CS is the speed of sound, which is 1 over root 3 for pure radiation in three dimensions. And then study the energy conservation equations, expanding in powers of the stress tensor expanding in powers of the stress tensor. Of course, this momentum is zero in the background. TTX is the momentum, which is zero in the background. So if I expand in powers of pi, I'm expanding in deviations of the actual value of the energy from the background. In everything I say, these deviations will be small, even though the waves become arbitrarily steep. Okay, so we're always going to be working in the regime where the waves are weak perturbations and the shocks are weak shock waves. So if you can show that stress energy conservation, just the equations on the previous page, imply this equation to second order in pi. And so this equation describes how a pi wave, a wave in pi, which is a function only of x plus t, so to lowest order that would be zero. In fact, it's a left-moving wave, I'm afraid. It should be a left-moving wave, not right-moving wave. So this pi to zeroth order is an arbitrary function of x plus t. But then when we include the nonlinear effect, you can think of this v variable as a time variable. And the other light cone coordinate is like a spatial variable. And that describes the evolution with the wave as I advance in this time. And this equation, this is exact to second order. And this equation will be familiar to anyone who studied shocks because it is the prototype equation for shock formation called Berger's equation. In that context, this is usually the Galilean sort of time t, and this would be x. And that's an equation taught in every course on shocks. The reason it's such a nice equation is you can solve it exactly, the Berger's equation, and see exactly for a given initial condition where the shocks form. So sinusoidal waves, a wave number k, steepen, and shocks form at exactly this time, when KCST is kappa over CS, 1 over epsilon. So that agrees with the heuristic argument I gave before, is that the wave simply catches up with itself and forms a shock, and you can study that exactly in one dimension. So the first thing we did was to study this in two dimensions. And so this is a simulation which Wei Li did. It's a full hydrodynamic simulation to all orders. You can study any amplitude wave in these simulations. And with zero viscosity, except, of course, the numerical viscosity. And this is what you see, that if we start at the beginning, which is hopefully coming soon, here is the initial Gaussian random field. as it evolves, you'll see these waves steepen and form fronts. And these fronts, what's actually plotted in the picture is the gradient, the magnitude of the gradient of the energy density, because that formally becomes infinite, so it shows the shock fronts very nicely. And you can see it's really very surprising. One of the features of the pattern is these shocks straighten out on scales which are just the speed of sound times t. In other words, the horizon scale on the universe. The shocks really extend. An individual shock extends one horizon, or some fraction of the horizon. And you'll notice this pattern is kind of like a crystal. I mean, it's a random superposition of waves, but they're all very straight. And so there's a lot of long-range correlations in this pattern. It's really fascinating. And you can study this analytically. I won't go through that, but you can study this analytically in a ray tracing approximation, which is very much like the Zeldovich approximation people use for dust, for gravitational clustering of dust. But in this case, there's no gravity. Gravity is unimportant. But you can follow the individual rays. So if you make the approximation that the wave you're studying has a much shorter wavelength than the waves it's traveling within, you can calculate the evolution of the wave front for the short wavelength waves. And basically, when you get causticks in the evolution of those short wavelength waves, that's when you form shocks. So in our paper, we go through this analytically. And in principle, we're developing this technique where we should be able to predict exactly where the shocks form in a simulation and compare it with the simulation, actually understand the whole thing analytically. So this morning, actually, we got results from 3D simulations. Now, there was an interesting issue here. And in fact, this question of shock formation was studied in the previous literature. In particular, if you look in Jim Peebles' book on the large-scale structure of the universe, you'll find in section 100 or something, there's a section on shock formation. He argued, fortunately, we didn't know about that section, okay, because in that section, he argues that the scaling here is 1/ε². Okay, of course he couldn't do any simulations at that time. It was much harder than now, and he gave a rough argument using a random walk, and his scaling was 1/ε², and this would have actually made the whole thing completely irrelevant for cosmology. But fortunately, we didn't know about Peebles' book, so we worked it all out for ourselves, and we figured out this scaling, And when we put our paper online, I wrote to Jim and said, you might be interested in this. And he said, oh, no, this disagrees with my book. But eventually, we resolved it. But to conclusively settle it, let me explain what the issue is. In 1D, as I said, the crests of a wave will catch up with the troughs, and it'll steepen and form a shock. However, you might worry. You see, this really relies on a nonlinear interaction between two collinear waves. Okay, so for example, if I have a wave which is cos kx, and I plug it into the equations, I'm going to have a source term, because I square it, the second order terms in the equations of motion will involve cos squared kx. So they source a wave of twice the wave number and also twice the frequency, because of course it'll be cos kx, cos kcst. You square that too. So you source a wave of twice the wave number at twice the frequency. That means you source it on resonance. Okay, you're driving the second order perturbation exactly on resonance, and that's the explanation for the secular growth and the breakdown of perturbation theory. Now that depends on the two waves being collinear. Okay, if they're non-collinear, then although their momenta, so the sum of their momenta, will have a magnitude which is not on resonance for the momentum for the sum. Okay, it's only on strictly on resonance when they're collinear. And so in 2D, you might say, oh, well, there's not much phase space for waves to be collinear, and so maybe this effect doesn't occur. And so a detailed analysis is needed to figure out exactly what proportion of phase space there is, and so on. And of course, even more of an issue in 3D, whether waves really are collinear enough to source this growth. So a combination of analytical work, of course, supported by numerical simulations, is needed to really settle the issue. And these are the first 3D simulations we have. Eric had to write a parallelized code. These are 1,000 cubed simulations. And I'm comparing here epsilon of 0.01, very small amplitude, which just agrees perfectly with linear theory. So the amplitude here is just so small that there hasn't been time for shocks to form. And here's exactly the same initial condition, but with 10 times the amplitude. And here you very clearly see these beautiful shocks. So movies are coming of the 3D case. We haven't yet got movies, but we just have stills. You can see that where there's the large scale features in this pattern are exactly what they are in that pattern. So what happens is that the long wavelength modes, you see the special thing in cosmology, and probably why this wasn't studied much in fluid dynamics, is that in cosmology you have a scale-free pattern, scale-free spectrum. And that means there's equal power, equal variance in the long wavelength modes as in the short wavelength modes. And those long wavelength modes are able to interact non-linearly with the short wavelength mode and transfer power to shorter and shorter wavelengths, driving the formation of shocks. Now, if you look at the shocks, of course, they're not going to be infinitely thin. Their width is going to be fixed by the viscosity of the fluid. And you can include this viscosity by supplementing the stress energy tensor with an extra term. Okay, so if I pull out the density out the front, then the extra term involves first derivatives of the velocity, and where this scale L is the ratio of the shear viscosity to the energy density. So Landau and Lifshitz argue that this form is the unique form fixed by the requirement that entropy increases when you include this the viscosity. So just taking this formula out of Landau and Lifshitz, you can look for a stationary solution which takes the form of a shock. It looks like a step function, and will sit in its rest frame. It moves at approximately the speed of sound. And if you solve the two equations for stress energy conservation with planar symmetry, then to second order in the perturbations, you get an equation like this. And these are the solutions. So the energy density profile looks like a tanh with amplitude epsilon. That's the strength of the shock. And the scale of the shock, the width of the shock, is given by this L, which is fixed by the shear viscosity, or roughly speaking, the diffusive scale. That scale L is roughly the mean free path in the plasma. And so it's fixed by the mean free path divided by epsilon. So if epsilon is 10 to the minus 4, as it is for primordial cosmological perturbations, then the width is actually 10 to the 4 times bigger than the thermal wavelength. But that's still a pretty small scale compared to the Hubble radius, which is the scale on which a given shock crosses the Hubble radius, oscillates a certain number of times, forms a shock. And the question, so if we assume only standard model physics, and then we study temperatures above the electroweak transition, things are much simpler above the transition. As you go below the transition, you have to deal with neutrino decoupling. And then it turns out that the process which dominates the viscosity is actually the neutrino mean free path. Neutrinos travel large distances and can damp away any features in the density below their mean free path. But above the electroweak transition, the viscosity is just determined by the temperature of the plasma, and various people have calculated this. G1 is the hypercharge coupling. It's roughly speaking the temperature cubed. And then, of course, the energy density is roughly the temperature to the fourth. So the viscous scale is just the thermal wavelength. And if you compare that with the Hubble radius, it's down by a factor of the temperature over the Planck mass. So if you're at the electroweak temperature, the thermal wavelength is 10 to the minus 17 of the Hubble radius. Okay, so basically a wave would cross the Hubble radius and oscillate 10 to the 17 times before it reached this viscous scale. But of course, shocks are a bit wider than the viscous scale. They're wider by 1 over epsilon, if their amplitude is epsilon. So you require that the width of the shock be smaller than epsilon times the Hubble radius. That's the scale on which shocks would form in the absence of viscosity. So if this is true, then you form shocks. Yeah. Right. Yes, our calculation ignores gravitational back reaction. As I showed you, that is only important for the first couple of oscillations. Okay, so this is just a standard linear theory calculation showing you how the Newtonian potential changes as the mode crosses the Hubble radius. So you notice that, you know, when it's well inside the Hubble radius, the Newtonian potential is zero. So you can just ignore gravitational back reaction after the first, well, even half an oscillation. Yeah. There's none. In the early universe, there's no free streaming. It's very tightly coupled. The photons are very tightly coupled. So in fact, the quantity that determines the photon free streaming is exactly this diffusive scale. So if you ask, where does this come from? This comes from hypercharge interactions, which are the weakest of the interactions in the electroweak theory, and therefore they allow the largest mean free paths. So it's always the largest mean free paths that determines the viscosity. Okay, so below the electroweak, it's a little bit more complicated. You've got to use the fact that the neutrinos have weaker scattering because the W boson, their scattering cross-section goes like 1 over MW to the fourth. And that enters, and as the temperature falls, goes like temperature to the fifth over MW to the fourth, the neutrino scattering rate goes like temperature to the fifth over MW to the fourth. And so the neutrinos have longer and longer mean free paths, and that's actually ultimately what stops the shocks forming. So if you work this out for epsilon of 10 to the minus 4, which is the number you get from the Planck satellite for the amplitude of the density variations, shocks only form in this temperature range, 10 to the 7 GV. And this is diffusion. If you go to temperatures above this temperature, then the diffusive scale, the shock width, is bigger than the scale on which the shocks would form. And the lower limit is set by neutrino damping, so it's about 1 GV. Now, later in this talk, I'm going to consider larger values of epsilon, because one of the interesting things we can do with this is bound the value of epsilon in the early universe. And it turns out we can do that today using current gravitational wave observations. We will be able to exclude values as large as 0.2 using gravitational wave observations. So if you do imagine that the primordial power spectrum for the density had a feature at very short wavelengths, as large as, so the density, the amplitude of the waves was 0.2, there are very few observations that could exclude that, okay? But we will come up with a way of excluding it using gravitational waves. Yeah. Yes, that's the motivation for this. Yes. If you make it 0.2, then basically the black holes will be the dark matter. Okay, and that what made us think about this was this paper by Bird and others, and there are earlier papers earlier this year motivated by LIGO. But if you take it as large as this, then you greatly broaden the range of accessible temperatures, because the shocks basically oscillate, the waves only have to oscillate 5 times, and then they form a shock. Okay, so now this temperature goes down to 10 MeV, and this temperature goes up to 10 to the 13 GeV. So we will be able to exclude perturbations as large as 0.2 over a much wider range of temperatures. And even the 10 to the minus 4, in principle, is accessible to future gravitational wave detectors. Okay, so let's think a little bit more about this network of shocks. There's a very interesting question of principle in thermodynamics, which is, what is the entropy deficit in the primordial plasma, okay, due to the acoustic waves? So if I give you a box and you know the maximum entropy state is absolute homogeneity, if I put some waves in it, that reduces the entropy. Okay, it must be a lower entropy state. So with as long as the fluid equations are satisfied, it will remain at that lower entropy state because the fluid equations conserve entropy. Okay, so the formation of shocks is actually associated with the restoration of thermal equilibrium. Okay, so that's very interesting to follow. The entropy density, so what is the entropy density? Well, what you do is go to the local rest frame of the fluid. That's why this gamma factor is needed. The entropy is rho to the 3/4 for a relativistic fluid. You expand this out and take the expectation value. The entropy of a collection of waves comes from the second order, because expectation value of delta is zero, right? So it comes at order delta squared, and the velocity and the delta are correlated because these are sound waves. So when you average over time and the statistical ensemble, this is what you get. So a collection of sound waves reduces the density below the equilibrium value by this amount. Now, conservation of energy and momentum across a shock determines the jump in entropy across the shock. So when you form a shock, the entropy jumps by this number, this fraction, I should say, not a factor. Well, yeah, it jumps by a factor. So the entropy jumps to 1 plus 164th epsilon cubed times the background density across a shock. And using these two equations, you can determine the rate of production of entropy then feeds back to tell you how the amplitude of the perturbations decays, the amplitude of the shocks decay. So you can get this equation which fixes how the shock amplitude decays with time. The scale lambda is the typical spacing between the shocks. So we check this in simulations. Here's the entropy. You put in a small perturbation of various amplitude. And that first-order differential equation shows you how the entropy rises towards the equilibrium value. So it's just another way of thinking about the early universe. Something happened at the Big Bang which put the radiation into a state of lower than maximal entropy, which consisted of these acoustic waves with a scale-invariant spectrum. And then the waves oscillated around, and they found their way back to thermal equilibrium via the formation of shocks. That's even if I completely ignore the viscosity. Okay, so it's an interesting sort of self-consistent picture. What are the potential consequences of these shocks? So I think there are many. We're only just beginning to explore all of them. But the one very interesting possibility is because the shocks cause a departure from local thermal equilibrium, this is at least one of the conditions for baryogenesis, that we now have an arrow of time. We have a region of the universe that's hotter, right next to one that's colder, and this is one of the conditions for baryogenesis. Whether you can turn this into a viable scenario remains to be seen, but it's certainly extremely minimal. This is the most minimal way anybody has ever pointed out for leaving local thermal equilibrium. Other proposals involve phase transitions and all kinds of other hypothetical phenomena for which there is no evidence in the standard model, for example. So this is the absolutely minimal mechanism for leaving local thermal equilibrium. It's inevitable, under the assumption that that scale invariant spectrum of acoustic perturbations continues down to small scales. This is inevitable. Secondly, you create primordial vorticity. So it turns out when two shocks collide, you see, a single shock doesn't make vorticity. But if two of them collide, then the intersection point leaves behind a trail of vortices. It leaves behind a sheet across which the tangential velocity is discontinuous. And that's basically a vortex sheet. So the collision of shocks generates vorticity. And from that vorticity, you can calculate the induced magnetic field. There is a magnetic field produced by this. And we're still in the process of figuring out exactly what it is. It's quite tricky. It's a problem in plasma physics. And there it's actually essential that you separate the positive from the negative charges so that you get currents and so on. But it's a mechanism for generating small-scale primordial magnetic fields. There is the possibility of fully developed turbulence around these vortex sheets. And again, that's something we're investigating. But certainly some very interesting nonlinear dynamics going on due to these vortices. Yeah.
Does it depend strongly on the strength of the shocks? Because actually one of the striking things about the movie that showed that we
made
is that it looked like they were
superposing. They do. So that's a very good point. You see, the shocks are weak. So if I follow a network of shocks for a small time, the evolution is exactly as in linear theory. I can linearly superpose shocks, and they just pass through each other. You need the long time, the time of order 1 over epsilon, to form the shocks. Okay, so basically, in this system, you need a long time to form the shocks. But once they're evolving, they're in linear theory. You can just superpose them. So the nonlinear effects only show themselves on a time of order 1 over epsilon. So in this case, the vorticity, so we saw the entropy is epsilon cubed. The vorticity, it depends on the situation. At most, it's epsilon cubed. In steady state shock collisions, it's epsilon to the fourth. Okay, so it, you know, it's suppressed by powers of epsilon. Certainly, you know, in linear theory, you get nothing because you just superpose. So they only happen at the next order. At best. So the other thing you'll get is inhomogeneities in the baryon to entropy ratio, again at some power of epsilon, and a stochastic gravitational wave background. So these people had studied this issue. So if I just take standard acoustic modes and I ask, do they generate gravitational waves? Well, the answer is yes, at second order. If I take the radiation density and velocity at second order, and I work out at horizon crossing how much tensor perturbation they generate, how much gravitational wave they generate, then you generate an Hij at order epsilon squared in second order perturbation theory, and that gives you a power spectrum which goes like epsilon to the fourth, and it gives you an energy density which depends on H squared going as epsilon to the fourth, and then of course you lose, so you generate epsilon fourth of the background energy density in gravitational waves. And then when the universe becomes matter-dominated, the gravitational waves redshift away faster than the matter, so the final omega in gravitational waves today has this primordial amplitude times the omega contributed by radiation today. So that's just in second-order perturbation theory. But what I'm going to discuss next is that actually these shocks generate gravitational waves in a very interesting way, much more interesting than that. And it will turn out that parametrically it's the same order. It's also at epsilon to the fourth. And it remains to be seen. We have all the tools. We should be able to calculate exactly whether the shocks or the second order effect dominate. This effect is already very interesting. If epsilon is 0.2, this is saying, you know, that number is about 10 to the minus 3. Omega radiation is 10 to the minus 4. And so this is 10 to the minus 7. Now, the pulsar timing array has already excluded 10 to the minus 9. Okay? So you can see that already we can exclude, using gravitational waves, large values of epsilon in the early universe. So let me talk a little bit about the gravitational waves from shocks. So naively, you don't get much because the shocks are a small-scale phenomenon, right? And when you emit gravitational waves, it pays to be big. So when you cross a wave crosses the horizon, there's a second-order effect. It's a nice big source, and naively, you know, anything that goes on sub-horizon scales is irrelevant. But the thing about the shocks is they are coherent over long times, okay? And you can sort of see that in the picture. They straighten out, and they last a long time, and that allows them to compete against horizon-scale second-order perturbations. So let me show you the mechanism, which is very cute, that if I have two gravitational waves colliding, the intersection between them generates gravitational waves. And this is by a Cherenkov mechanism. So as far as I know, this has never been studied in gravitational waves before, but it's really the analog of Cherenkov radiation in electromagnetism. So here are the two shocks. Here's one of them moving. I should say it hasn't. I think it's been studied, but for some very contrived solutions. They weren't particularly motivated, so you can always introduce some source which does this. But this way of generating them is really vanilla. It's inevitable, has to be there in a radiation fluid, and with perturbations. So it's much better, much more motivated in that sense. Okay, so here's the shock. Moving along. And what I've shown are shocks which have a profile which extends over a finite wavelength. So the extent of the shock will be the scale on which the density perturbation goes away to zero. And that will be to do with the wavelength when the shock formed. What was the wavelength of the perturbations when the shock formed? So it carries with it memory of that wavelength, but it's straighter on a much larger scale. So here's one shock, and here's the other shock, and they cross in this region. And just as Matt said, you can linearly superpose them. That's a solution for a long time. And so just linearly superpose these two colliding shocks. And then in the intersection region, you have a stress tensor. You see the stress tensor goes like rho VI, VJ. And so one of them is giving one value for the velocity, another one's giving the other value for the velocity. The combination gives you a source term which drives tensor tensor modes. Now, if they intersect at an angle theta, then the velocity of the intersection point is just given by geometry. So let's assume both these initial shocks had speed of sound. Then just by geometry, the ratio of this velocity to that velocity is the sine of the angle. So the intersection point, x, moves to the right with a velocity greater than the speed of sound. And if theta is bigger than some value, this is greater than the speed of light. So the spatial stress moves faster than the speed of light. And anything moving faster than light generates Cherenkov radiation. So let me give you a little explanation of Cherenkov radiation in electromagnetism. It's really very beautiful. I haven't seen this derivation in a textbook. If you look in Jackson, he does it in a rather complicated way using Fourier transforms and so on. But it really is very simple. Take a charged particle, work out its electrostatic potential, and now boost it. Okay? So this is the boosted electrostatic potential. It's got a gamma because it's a time component of a four vector. And then we boosted the x to get this formula. And now just formally allow v to be bigger than 1. Okay, so you notice that the gamma factors cancel, so there won't be any problem with the square root, because the gamma cancels between the top and the bottom. And so v is bigger than 1, and this coefficient is gamma is the 1 over gamma squared is fine if v is bigger than 1, except that there's now a singularity where y squared plus z squared equals some number times x squared. So what this describes is a cone, a distribution where the electrostatic potential is 0 everywhere in front of the cone. And then within the cone, it's this expression which has a square root divergence on the cone. And this is indeed the solution in Jackson's book for the electrostatic potential of a charge moving at faster than speed of light. Now, a cute thing that happens is if you say, instead of a particle, I've got a line of charge, okay, moving faster than speed of light, well, then you get to integrate over one of these coordinates, the z coordinate, let's say. And when you do that, you find a constant. So inside the wedge, the potential is constant. The vector potential is also constant. And outside the wedge, it's 0. And this is the exact solution for a charge line moving faster than the speed of light. Okay, so the electric, and we're all familiar with the fact that if you take a charge and boost it, its field gets squashed into a pancake. Okay, in this case, when it goes faster than the speed of light, the pancake bends backwards, and all the electric and magnetic fields are inside these sheets. Gravitational waves, you can do the same thing. It's a little more involved. But basically what happens is, and there's another issue that I've got the fluids moving. I've got these two shock waves going at CS. Of course, gravitational waves go at C. And so what characterizes the pattern of gravitational waves is a sort of bow wave, but where the angle is bigger because C is bigger than CS. And so you have this geometry. The source is going faster than the speed of light. There's a pattern behind the source. And then if you calculate the strength of Hij, it's 0 everywhere in front of the wave. And as I go behind the wave, it goes up to a constant. So this generates a sort of memory, gravitational metric perturbation, which is just constant. So behind this wave, you have a constant metric perturbation. Of course. What matters to produce gravitational waves is the spatial stress, right? T-I-J. It's a spatial stress. So what I'm saying is that there is a pattern of spatial stress which is stationary in a frame moving faster than the speed of light. Okay? And that's all I need. I'm not actually transporting energy or momentum or anything else faster than the speed of light. It's just the spatial stresses. It doesn't violate anything.
Yeah. Maybe I could just follow up on that, because I wouldn't have expected the shocks individually to produce gravitational radiation.
Yeah, they don't.
And
this is a second order.
We're working in second order.
Absolutely. Okay. So I said the stress tensor goes like VI, VJ for the fluid. So I take the V from one shock and the V from the other shock, multiply them, and they have a different pattern. And then you take the tensor projection of that, and that's where the source comes from. Yeah, so it's at second order. So the Hij is at order epsilon squared. And that's why the density in gravitational waves goes like epsilon to the fourth. OK. Now, so that's Cherenkov radiation from a single shock, from a pair of shocks, and you can compute it analytically. And it has this very interesting field where the H goes to a constant behind the shock intersection. Of course, it won't really go to a constant because the extent of the shocks are finite, and the field, this Hij is going to fall away again as you come to the ends of these two shocks. But locally, it should be a very good approximation. So in general, you want to take the spatial stress tensor, Fourier decompose it into scalar, vector, and tensor pieces, and then you want to you want to focus on the spatial stress tensor of the fluid, compute its unequal time correlator, and use that as a source for your power spectrum of gravitational waves. So you can we are measuring these correlators. We can model the correlators and then solve analytically for the radiation of gravitational waves, and this will allow us to get the predictions very cleanly and very accurately. Here's an example. This is a power spectrum from shocks in 2D. So we start off with a distribution of waves, and actually in this case we put a cutoff in K at 64, and so we had some initial oscillations. Then what we see is that nonlinear effects push the power up here. The power up here is all due to nonlinear effects. The shocks have a lot of power at high K, and that's the distribution of shocks, which we model in a certain way. And using this, the model for not just for T00, but well, actually for Tij tensor, we will be able to get the spectrum of gravitational waves. Now, I want to end by talking about this Bird preprint, which was very good for us because it put forward a hypothesis that involved large values of epsilon, okay, which would be nice to rule out. So their point was that if you used existing constraints on black holes being a significant fraction of the dark matter, they allowed this window at 30 solar masses. So microlensing excluded smaller, and then an argument about binaries excluded larger, but 30 solar masses was just fine, and when advanced LIGO saw 30 solar mass black holes, they said, aha, maybe we've seen the dark matter. And this is the picture they had in mind. Where could these black holes have come from, right? How were the 30 solar mass black holes formed? Well, their idea was in the primordial power spectrum of density perturbations, maybe there was a spike at 30 solar masses, at a wave number corresponding to scale today of 30 solar masses. To have that be true, because if you assume a Gaussian random field, the likelihood of very rare peaks is suppressed by the error function of 1 over epsilon squared, the standard deviation of the primordial density field. And so on that scale. And what you want is that fraction of space, so the fraction of space with density perturbation of order one has to be equal to the fraction of the radiation that you want to turn into black holes. And you know what that is because you know what the omega you want today in black holes is, for example, 0.25, the omega of dark matter. And then there's a redshifting factor because the radiation when you compress the radiation into a black hole, of course, it will scale like matter rather than the density of the black holes will scale like matter, not radiation. So you can solve this for the epsilon that you need for a given omega black hole. And for example, if I take the omega black hole to be 0.25, to be the dark matter, and I assume the black holes form when that scale crossed the horizon, which turns out to be 1 GeV, then you need an epsilon of 0.2. So that's what the Bird et al. Scenario involved. And of course, we realize that such a large epsilon is going to give us a nice big signal of gravitational waves. Notice, by the way, that as you change this omega of black holes today, as you lower it, so if you say they're not the dark matter, but I just want to constrain the density of black holes, actually, the epsilon you require only changes logarithmically. Okay, so going down to very tiny values of omega in black holes is going to be possible because the bound on omega black hole increases exponentially as you increase the bound on epsilon. So here's how we look for gravitational waves. It's a really exciting situation. The first detection, of course, on a frequency of hundreds of hertz. On higher frequencies, there's an experiment at Fermilab called a holometer, which is a meter scale experiment with projected high sensitivity, also H's of 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 21. There's proposed LISA, of course, which will only fly in a while, but there's this European pulsar timing array, which is working on scales of parsecs, and that's already setting limits on omega and gravitational waves less than 10 to the minus 9, and that will improve quickly with time. And then I think the next talk we're going to hear about square kilometer array, this is going to hugely advance the subject and allow us to lower that limit on primordial gravitational waves very quickly. So these are the temperatures we would be probing through the formation of shocks from 100 GeV to 10 MeV. This is from 10 to the minus 10 seconds after the Big Bang to microseconds after the Big Bang, and these are the scales of the the black holes, which would correspond to the horizon scale at that time. So it's a very interesting prospect using the emission of gravitational waves from these primordial perturbations to constrain what the universe was doing at those very early times. So
10 to the minus 3
here? Oh, no. This is the black hole mass. So 30 solar masses would be here, and that corresponds to wavelengths which are now being constrained by this pulsar timing array. Okay, so this is saying that 30 solar mass black holes comprise some significant fraction of the dark matter. And then if you figure out what is the temperature, that's at 10 MeV or so, and that corresponds to this pulsar timing array. So this is under the assumption these black holes are a significant fraction of the dark matter.
Yes.
So we use the pulsar timing array to rule those guys out. We can also rule out, these measurements will allow us to rule out black holes of these masses being a significant fraction of the dark matter. Okay, and as I said, that limit is going to grow going to fall exponentially as our bounds on omega gravitational waves goes down. That's right. That's right. Yes, on a given wavelength, as the sensitivity comes down, you can say that the allowed values of epsilon, in other words, the level of density fluctuations in the early universe on that scale, is bounded more and more strongly. Okay? So you could say that and eventually you'll hit 10 to the minus 4. Right, so even for 10 to the minus 4, I gave a talk at MIT and showed this slide, and Ray Weiss got very excited because he said, 10 to the minus 4 gives, this is 10 to the minus 16, this is 10 to the minus 4, that's 10 to the minus 20. He said, that's not inconceivable by any means, that we could bring the limit on omega down to 10 to the minus 20, and in that case, we have to see this signal. Unless for some reason the primordial power spectrum has no power on short wavelengths, which seems extremely unlikely. Okay, so that is all. Just to summarize, if the primordial spectrum has strong features on small scales, we'll be able to see them using gravitational waves. Already excludes the Bird et al. Scenario using the pulsar timing array bound. We will be able to probe the very early universe using gravity waves, even in minimal cosmological scenarios. So, of course, inflation produces gravitational waves. But even without inflation, this mechanism will operate. Okay, thank you. Yes, but there are so many sources.
Yeah, there are so many sources.
It's very random. No, you can't distinguish the individual ones. You can just see. So that's why. That's why we call it a stochastic background. So statistics in time and angle should be Gaussian. Okay, so it's very sad. But you're superposing lots of very interesting events, but there are too many of them, and the consequence is Gaussianity. Yeah, so I think, I mean, maybe we're missing something, but I think the expectation is this will be very Gaussian background. And so all you can really measure is the strength of it. And the spectrum is, the spectrum is determined by the primordial spectrum. So in the minimal scenario, where all scales have perturbations of 10 to the minus 4, you would just see a flat spectrum in frequency. Well, No. Inflation is really approximately scale invariant. So the if you fit your inflation model to large scale observations, NS is 0.97, right?
Yeah,
so if I take 0.97 and extrapolate. Yeah.
So using that scale, if you want R to be large, let's say NP has to be smaller. Anyway, so using that equation, I think inflation always comes up at a very, very low
I don't understand the point.
I think you can produce much more than inflation under the
microscope. Well, that's true. I mean, these are scalar perturbations, so we can put in whatever we like. But if we take the minimal scenario, scalars only, then with a scale invariant spectrum, or even 0.97, just extrapolate the 0.97 down to short scales, we will get these values for the gravitational wave background.
Okay.